Paul Robeson was the son of a former slave. In his own way, his story is even more remarkable than Richard Wright's because he went on to achievements almost unimaginable considering the circumstances of his time. He was an acclaimed athlete, a brilliant scholar, one of the world's most famous singers, and a star in films and on stage. But the more he performed, the more he became aware of his past, and that led to his prominent role as a political activist. Well, joining me now is his son, Paul Robeson Jr., the author of a book called The Undiscovered Paul Robeson, An Artist's Journey, 1898 to 1939. It's published by John Wiley and Sons. Welcome back to New York and Company, Paul.
Oh, thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
Now, this book ends in 1939, so I assume you're working on a second volume.
I am, very much so.
And most of this took place before you were born, then?
No, I'm 12 when this book ends. So, interestingly enough, from years 7 to 12, I got to know him reasonably well. I have some very vivid impressions from that.
How aware were you at that time, just how remarkable a man your father was? Because most people who grow up, the sons of famous people or daughters of famous people, just see them as mom and dad.
No, I was aware from very young. First of all, he had an extraordinary voice, speaking voice as well as singing voice, so it's an instrument that no child could ever forget, especially if you're around him.
So if he was chastising you, he said, Paul, it meant something.
He wasn't
different.
A chastiser. The interesting thing is that he had a very soft and gentle personality. When he was very angry, he was very quiet. Mm-hmm. He was never a shouter. No, his personality is vastly different from the mythologies about him. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book.
And why?
But I was very much aware that he was an extraordinary person, not only from being around him, but from the way people treated him. He's like a king without a crown.
You say...
natural.
You want us to see this other side. That's why you've called it the undiscovered Paul Robeson.
Yeah.
There's been a lot written about him in the past. You feel that all of it missed a certain side?
Yes, nobody wrote about who he was. That is the person, mm-hmm. his personality, his motivations, his roots, the fact that he was a deeply religious man with a belief in a divine commitment and that his gifts were divine, and also his way of thinking, his behavior, the way he treated people, the way people treated him, and what I would say his spiritual dimension, not charisma, but something which is more than power or skill. In folk legend, it's called a shamanic dimension, mm-hmm. like a shaman.
Well, it's
he was naturally that way. Well, that's different. It's different. He affected people in a way that great religious leaders do, although he wasn't a quote religious leader, like, say, Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Nehru had that quality, for example.
Do you think that people have missed the religious side because we associate him so much with communism, which was at least on an official level atheistic, that we would think that his politics would have been his religious politics would have been pretty much predictable?
No, I think it's because certainly in America, people are monocultural. So most Americans who aren't of some minority or other have very little understanding of other cultures. He came from another culture. He embodied that culture. And certainly white Americans filtered out everything that wasn't familiar to them and thought he was just like them.
Well,
so they have no idea about his culture, not just his religion.
His father was a minister.
A minister, but he came from a very specific West African culture. He was descended from the Igbo tribe, if we're going to be specific, which has a very definite tradition which lasted through the centuries and which is rooted in certain parts of the South. And Dad embodied that culture all his life. I think people overwhelmed the culture with the politics.
His father had been a slave, but he was really in touch with his African roots so much that he thought of himself as Igbo?
Well, Dad discovered that he was Igbo on the set of Sanders of the River by talking to people from Nigeria who told him that the rhythm of his speech in English was from a specific district northeast of Lagos. So, and evidently in many areas in the South, African Americans maintain the rhythm of speech and the cultural traditions of their African tribes. Dad's father was very much in the Southern preacher's tradition. In that sense, Dad is very similar to, say, Martin Luther King a generation later.
But he didn't go on to be a minister, even though his father would have preferred that.
No, Dad was not an organization person. He was by nature personally a free spirit. He never would attach himself to any organization, not just political party, but a church organization or any kind. He was very much an individual free spirit, although he had this immense self-discipline, so people couldn't put together those contradictory parts of him.
How old was he before people realized that he was destined to be rather remarkable?
He recalls that the people around his father's church treated him that way. Well, you're going to amount to something, Paul. He had that sense from the time he was 7, 8 years old, a kid, small child.
And he wound up going to Rutgers.
He didn't. He wanted to go to Lincoln University, where his father and brother, black college. He didn't want the hassle of dealing with a white college, and his father insisted that he try for this scholarship, and he won. I think his father wanted Dad to become everything that he could be, and to do that, he realized he had to go to a major white college.
Was he the only black at the school at the time?
For the first year, yes. During his second year, another black student came named Davenport, and they then could live in the dorm because they roomed together. Before that, Dad had to live off campus because he couldn't room with a white student.
Well, here's this guy who becomes immediately one of the academic stars of the school and then one of its great athletes. Was this expected because he'd gotten the scholarship, or was everybody surprised at just how incredibly well he succeeded?
He had a sense of ability to succeed by the time he was in high school. That is, it turns out that I found out in the course of writing the volume that he was considered to be the greatest defensive player in the history of New Jersey high school football, and that he was so dominant as a high school football player that they changed the rules to try and cut down his effectiveness. So he entered college with a sense of immense ability and confidence and power, and he was a dominant college football player, the dominant college football player for 2 years, which then is amazing, like a double Heisman Trophy winner. Mm-hmm. So that has not in the past been brought to the fore, that he was not only a great All-American, but perhaps the greatest defensive football player ever in college.
But Rutgers seems to have an ambivalent attitude toward him. On the one hand, they're very proud of this man who's doing so much. On the other hand, they don't make him captain of the football team, despite his being...
It was against the rules. That is, no black man could go out on the field and do the coin toss and whatnot in America at that time. One of the most viciously racist times in the history of America.
Which I mean, 1915 lynching, through 1919.
1915 through 1919, north, south, east, and west. I mean, Woodrow Wilson probably was responsible for my grandfather's losing his pastorate because he had nerve enough to ask Wilson to take his eldest son, William, into Princeton and forced him to say, "We don't take colored." And apparently he was angry enough that he got William Drew, my grandfather, fired. So from the president on down, the entire society was viciously racist. Rutgers was normally racist for a place like that. They took him in after he made the team, But, for instance, they would happily have him sing on the steps of a fraternity, but he couldn't walk in the door of the fraternity, even when he was a star. It was just the way the society was, and Dad was very much aware of that. So he didn't bother with social life on campus. His social life was in the black communities in New Jersey and as far down as Philadelphia.
My guest is Paul Robeson, Jr. His book, The Undiscovered Paul Robeson, An Artist's Journey, 1898 to 1939, is published by John Wiley, and you're listening to New York & Company on AMA 20 WNYC in New York. Your father even played professional football for a little while. If he had been a baseball player, he wouldn't have been allowed.
That's correct. Actually, in the early years of the NFL, blacks could play. It's the only professional sport they could play.
And then that ended in the 40s when Marion Motley and some others came
back. Well, it wasn't until the late 40s. But in those years, it was kind of a pickup league, and they just needed stars. And the best black college players, and there were very few, maybe four or five, were very much sought after in the pro leagues. He was a pro star for a couple of years, actually.
And what do you think sports gave him?
Well, I have as a metaphor the way he made the team. That is, football has been the macho sport in America. To be the dominant football player in the country as a college football player for a black man was not only pioneering but extraordinary. It had an immense impact on the country as a whole, and for him, it was part of his mission that as a youngster he felt that his mission was to do something to improve the condition of his people and to fight this monster of racism that he grew up seeing the depth of it, although sheltered from it somewhat by his extended family. His father gave him that tradition, the quiet but unbreakably resistant slave tradition, which gave us not just Frederick Douglass, but also Nat Turner, that there's a time when it's better to die on your feet than live on your knees. And when he made the team and picked this guy up as if to kill him, as if to break his back, it was his statement that he never looked back on, that white people should understand that black people will kill if necessary in self-defense in a certain level of racism. And that's a very important piece.
Well, it was almost an outlet
of
for
his life.
Aggression.
No, it wasn't. It was a statement that African Americans are full people and will die like others in defense of that. That's much, it was not personal. As a matter of fact, he learned to do that by his father teaching him how to control both rage and fear.
Now, he went to Columbia Law School, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because that's a way to change the world. But then he dropped out. Did he see this other career that was developing as a performer as a better platform for himself?
He aspired to the pinnacle of power, success, not for himself, but to make a statement as an African American on behalf of his people, because he realized he had this immense talent. The law was not a place for him, he decided, because he couldn't go anywhere in it. He couldn't even be a trial lawyer, let alone a Supreme Court judge. In the theater, in the arts, he had immense latitude to be anything he could be, and that's what drew him to that. And the consciousness early on that he had an extraordinarily gifted voice, that he knew from a young child.
But he was relatively untrained, and yet he goes on to become a very famous singer. He's relatively untrained as an actor and becomes one of the premier actors of the world. I mean, he introduces a number of Eugene O'Neill roles. He plays Othello.
That's correct.
He's not some guy. He's not doing the O.J. Simpson comedy bits in somebody else's movies.
Well, I think one has to go back to the church tradition. One of the great cultural traditions in African-American life is the black preacher, who is prophet and performer all in one. That's a performance. His father, my grandfather, was one of the great preachers in the tradition of the great preachers. And Dad, having the voice that he had, used it most of his life. When he lost his mother and was kind of a loner, he sang to himself, and he realized what kind of voice. He also had perfect pitch and was able to sing a cappella and could move people. So he loved, he sang at parties. So with this instrument, he understood he could do things that other people couldn't. Beyond that, he was a natural actor. He hid behind 100 faces. He never got into a fight. Because he was by nature this huge guy, very powerful, but gentle by nature. Never wanted to fight unless he had to. So he had 100 different ways to present a different aspect of himself. So he was a natural actor in that sense, and realized that as a singer on stage, he had an immense natural skill, which he on his own honed for many, many years.
We have very little time left, so I can't really get into Old Man River and all those other things. I want to talk a moment about your mother and father.
Mm-hmm.
A large part of the book's text is the correspondence and early and diary entries of Paul and your mother, Essie. They had a problematic relationship.
Indeed. Well, they were extraordinary personalities separately and together. Don't forget, they were like a royal couple for almost 20 years. These young people that rocketed to fame in 3-4 years. So there were those stresses. She had lost her father as a kid, fatherless child, fatherless daughter, motherless son. They came together because they were able to meet each other's needs on so many different levels. On the other hand, they were utterly different personalities. So you had all of these things mixing. He was a free spirit. She tended to be possessive. So they finally, after a lot of conflict, came together on a kind of a part marriage, but also part business arrangement. Some of the romance went out of it, but they cobbled together a relationship that survived 44 years. So,
although there were a couple of moments, divorce discussed, he had the
indeed
affair
there were
Peggy
other
Ashcraft,
women
here with Yolanda Jackson.
Well, the interesting thing is, too much has been made of that. His relationships with other women weren't one night stands. They were usually, always, as a matter of fact, relationships that lasted many years. And the women he had affairs with were his friends, not just. The complicated man, and too much has been made of, I would say, the cliche approach to marriage, and he was unconventional in every way.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. We'll talk about this more and get into the politics more with the second volume, which comes out when?
I hope in about 18 months.
Okay, see you then. Paul Robeson Jr.
Well, thanks
book,
a lot.
The Undiscovered Paul Robeson from John Wiley.